Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Brian Camp, whose new book is The City of Lost Fortunes, and Iris Cohen, whose debut novel is The Little Clam. Brian Camp started writing his first novel, The City of Lost Fortunes, in the backseat of his parents' car as they evacuated for Hurricane Katrina. That's quite a story. But now, all these years later, we have the fine results, The City of Lost Fortunes. Brian has studied creative writing with some of my very favorite writers. He has a degree from the University of New Orleans, and he's now writing full-time after teaching several years at Dominican and Delgado and in East St. John Parish. Brian Camp, it's a real pleasure. Welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So, are you a real fan of fantasy fiction? Was this always something you wanted to write?
Definitely. My mother read Dune when she was pregnant with me. So I've got it pretty much from conception on. When I was in junior high, seventh grade, I read through the entirety of our school library's mythology section. From a very early age, I've been into fantasy and science fiction and myth and all of those things together.
Oh, that really shows in this book, all that mythological background. So tell us about The City of Lost Fortunes. Tell us about this wonderful story of New Orleans and a magician who loves her.
So the basic premise of the book is it's a murder mystery.
Yes.
And it's in a New Orleans where the gods of many different world mythologies all kind of coexist behind the scenes. The main character is a demigod who knows his father was a god but doesn't know which god was his father. And he has a debt that he owes to the fortune god of New Orleans. And that debt is called in, and he has to go to a poker game. And at the poker game is Toth from Egyptian myth, Legba from voodoo, an angel, a vampire, and the fortune god of New Orleans. And it happens very early in the book, so it's not really a spoiler to tell you that the fortune god gets murdered right after the game. And so he gets pulled into this plot of trying to figure out who did it and why.
But it's a poker game unlike any other. It is really stunning. And the whole thing is so suspenseful. It's just a page turner. You just sit there and read it. I read it all in one day. You know, New Orleans is such a fantastical city. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and it does have some supernatural beings associated with it, of course.
Right.
So talk about the challenges of putting this all together.
It took me a long time to get the courage to actually write about this city because for two reasons. One, the second you mess anything up, almost to the point that even if you haven't published it yet, if it's just you think about writing something that's wrong, somebody will tell you that you did something wrong. The second thing is that New Orleans itself is kind of a myth. Everybody has their idea of what New Orleans is, and it varies from lifestyle to lifestyle, from person to person even. Part of the challenge of writing this book was just having the courage to say that my idea of what New Orleans is was worth putting down on paper.
Mm-hmm. And it took you how many years to write this book?
Since Katrina.
And you have this anxiety about getting New Orleans right, even though you're from here.
Yeah, it's a hard city to get right, I think. And there are so many depictions of the city that get close, and it's that one glaring detail that it's just grit and an oyster, you know?
Wow.
And so it feels like it's perfect, and then you get that one thing, and it ruins the whole feeling.
Well, I appreciate that perfectionism, because countless out-of-towners come here and get it wrong, as you know. So I wanted you to read a little bit from one of the introductory sections because you set the tone so beautifully and your writing about mythology is so elegant and pleasant to read. And I thought it would give people a wonderful taste of this book. So here you go.
They are intermediaries between mankind and the divine, descending from the heavens on outstretched wings. They appear all throughout history, delivering guidance to the lost, rescuing those in mortal peril, bestowing luck to the unfortunate. The ancient Greeks poured out the first few drops of wine in honor of Agathos, a eudaimon. Timbaru was the chieftain of the Gandharvas, the name by which the followers of Hindu know them. Chitragupta records the actions of all Sikhs, whereas Kiramun and Katabin do the same for Muslims, one recording good works, the other misdeeds. Jophiel, wielding a flaming sword, expelled Adam and Eve from the garden. Samael is with a person at the moment of death. Uriel guides them to their destiny. Their names are more than identity. They are their purpose, their existence. God heals, Raphael. The strength of God, Gabriel. Messenger, angel.
That's one of my favorite parts. It's so rich, a reading experience, because of this, because of all those things you read, you know, when you were young.
Right.
Did you feel that as you were writing it?
When I started those little myth sections, honestly, at first, they were a way for me to be a teacher and,
exactly.
and kind of hide my work at the same time, because I knew that I wanted to talk about syncretic myth. And I knew that a lot of people don't know what syncretic myth is. And so those little passages were a way for me, just in the back of my head, to show that there are these connections throughout mythology, that every culture has a werewolf in some
yes.
sense, that every culture has a flood story, or that many cultures have flood stories, and that there's a particular human way of telling stories that occurs over and over and again in myth. And my way of kind of connecting those things, connecting those ideas for a writer, we call that info dumping.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way of putting information on the page and then making it pretty to hide it from the reader.
Yeah.
In the same way that, you know, when I was teaching Hamlet, I had my students act out the play, partly because it helps them actually learn what Shakespeare was intending, but also because if high school students have to just read from a book, they're getting a lot less out of it than if they get to whack each other with fake swords for a little while.
Oh, I bet you were a great teacher. They loved your classes. But that's part of the pleasure of this book. And in terms of world building, which is what everybody does when they're writing fantasy, it makes it so strong and believable to put it in this great context. And one of the things you write about that's so lovely is that you write about cities as gods.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted you to read a little bit about that, too.
Most people, even those who think they understand the supernatural, really have no idea how complex and how strange things can be. Humans easily recognize the gods that are most like themselves. But in the same way that gods come in a variety of shapes and sizes, no one type of consciousness has an exclusive right to godhood. Animals have their own gods, and so do trees and computers and storms. There are deities of mountain and ocean for whom a single prayer has lasted longer than the whole span of human existence. And there are virus gods, microscopic and fierce, whose entire immortalities pass unnoticed before our eyes. Cities, too, can be gods. Some of the ancient city gods have been asleep for centuries, places like Byblos and Nin, Samarkand and Ile-Efe. There are older cities that are still awake, mad old London and reserved Beijing, Jerusalem, who argues with herself in four different voices, and Mexico City, who only answers to the name Tenochtitlan. And younger cities, Sydney and New York, Tokyo and Brussels and Chicago, are bursting with energy and myth, trying to figure out who exactly they are. New Orleans might be young and small among city gods, since most cities take centuries to develop enough history and charm and myth to attain an identity, if ever. But the Crescent City has been a god almost from her very beginning.
See, we all like that. I love that mad old London, too.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to balance all this with the structure of a murder mystery. So you have all these great descriptions working, all this mythical background working. But at the same time, you're proceeding along a traditional mystery plot.
That actually went the other way around. So when I first kind of conceived of this book, I was taking two classes at the same time, Bev Marshall's undergraduate fiction class at Southeastern and a detective fiction class. I dropped out of American Lit and took a detective fiction class. So I had those two things going at the same time. I had creative writing assignments and noir mysteries we were reading. Uh-huh. So, you know, Heaven's Prisoners and Dashiell Hammett and all these great books were kind of rolling around in my head as I was thinking about things that I had to write. So the assignment that Bev gave us right before the storm hit, we had to write a scene. The assignment was focused on description. And so she was like, okay, so describe the wallpaper, describe the air, describe the light, describe everything. And then when we got to the, you know, as we were writing, as we were thinking, she kept telling us, describe this, describe this. And then right at the very end, she said, now put something unusual in it. And so with all of those thoughts of noir detective stuff, I was like, okay, well, I'll describe a backroom poker game. And so I was describing it, you know, with the smoke in the air and the, right. you know, the seedy kind of environment. And then she said, now put something interesting in it. Put something different. And I was like, well, what doesn't belong in a backroom poker game? Well, an angel. And so I inserted an angel into that moment. And then when I read that kind of descriptive paragraph or a couple of paragraphs out to the class, they were all like, "Ooh, that sounds cool." So I know I had something there. Uh-huh. And that paragraph actually is still pretty much in the book as it was mm-hmm. when I wrote it 15 years ago. So she said, okay, now that you have this scene, go home and start writing about it. Start to build a scene or a short story or something with it. And so I thought, okay, well, what's in my head? And what was in my head were all of these different mysteries, all these different murder mysteries. It always kind of started from a murder mystery, and the more myth came into it, the more I mean, it was always going to be some kind of fantasy because or science fiction, because that's what drives my engine, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
But the more myth came into it and the more mythic the world got in my head, the more I kept turning back to that, the simplicity of a murder mystery. When you're talking about myth, it's very easy to get into world-changing threats and uh-huh. massive kinds of things. And I wanted a smaller story. I wanted a character-based story. So anytime the story started to get too big, I turned it back to the plot of the murder mystery.
The fortune god of New Orleans ought to be big enough. So tell us a little bit about Jude Dubuisson. He is a magician with a particular talent.
He can find lost things.
I wish I knew him better.
Partly it was an easy plot thing to have that kind of talent that enables a character to do things that the ordinary person can't. But I also wanted it to be somehow relevant. And so the idea of the book came full circle with the idea of so much was lost in the storm.
Right.
And so when you say he finds lost things, you immediately jump to a couple of things. Where are my car keys? Where did I leave that piece of jewelry that I know I had at one point, but it's gone now? But, you know, we're talking about magic and myth. And so we lose a lot more throughout the course of our lives than I think we realize. There are versions of us that are gone, mm-hmm. that we move past and that are, we don't know what we did with them, you know? And so those things are lost. And we kind of can remember what it was like to be a child, but that child is gone. And friendships and things like that, it's sometimes hard to pinpoint the moment at which you and a friend stopped being friends. And that, to me, is a kind of lost thing. Mm-hmm. And so those are the things that this character could find for you. He could tell you, this moment, this is the time in which you lost your friend. And knowing that moment, maybe you could fix it. Maybe you could find that friend again. And so that was part of where I was going with the character. Is once I knew that part of him, that it was lost things, I wanted to kind of explore what it means to be a person who knows where people have lost things and how that might affect a person.
Mm-hmm. He's the right man in the right place at the right time. It was very rich, I think. We've been talking with Brian Camp, whose wonderful new book is The City of Lost Fortunes. You can meet him Tuesday, April 17th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This has been great.
Iris Cohen was born and raised in New Orleans. We're speaking to her today from her home in Brooklyn, where she lives with her husband and two children. Iris is celebrating the publication of her first novel, The Little Clan, a truly wonderful book about being young in New York, loving books, and making your way in the world. Iris Cohen, I am so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you so much. Wonderful to be here.
So first of all, tell us about the title, The Little Clan, which comes from Proust.
It does. The Little Clan is what is the name of a salon in Search of Lost Time. So it's sort of this very famous benchmark of a literary salon. And the irony is that in Proust, the salon, it isn't quite as literary as the people in it sort of hope it will be. And so it's kind of a nod to the reader that this is going to be a book about literature and literary history and salons, but also about society and sort of a comedy of manners and the ways in which things turn out differently than we might expect them to.
So tell us about your protagonist, Ava. She's one of those dreamy heroines who lives very much inside her head, but she's able to cope with the gritty realities of life as well.
Yes, Ava definitely, she goes through a voyage over the course of this book. At the beginning of the book, she's working as a librarian in this grand old private club. All of the members are much older. The inside is very Victorian. And she basically is hiding out there in this space that really reminds her of all of these classic books that she loves so much. And then things happen. Her friend Stephanie pops back into town and sort of drags her into this project together. And once they start this literary club, it kind of takes off and it drags Ava sort of out of herself and forces her into the world in which she sort of comes into her own in a lot of ways.
Now, this is a novel that's very much about the life we live in books. And Ava does that. She lives in books. She writes with a quill, which I find very endearing.
Yeah, it's been fun to sort of talk to readers. And I keep running into people that say, oh, my God, Ava was me. You know, I was reading Little House on the Prairie by candlelight in my room at night, or I was making myself cups of tea and pretending to be in Pride and Prejudice. And so I think it does sort of touch this feeling that a lot of people have who love books of sort of living very intensely through books, and especially a bookish or shy younger person. That's really sort of your most visceral experience of life sometimes is what you live through books. And that just seems like a nice thing to talk about, really, and explore.
Mm-hmm. And this is very much a novel about women. It's about female friendships. It's about mother-daughter relationships. It's about women writers. It's about the way women see their lives in books.
Yes, definitely. And in the way that a lot of books have not necessarily been the story of women's lives as told by women, which is one of the things that Ava sort of comes to terms with, is that her world has been built on all of these classic novels that she read, and so many of them were written by men. And so for her to really come into her own as a young woman and as the writer she wants to be, she has to sort of go back and question all of these things that she's read and find out what it really means to speak for yourself as a literary person and as a woman.
And when she turns to Virginia Woolf, the results are wonderful. Aren't they always? Aren't they always?
I mean, they are. It's very hard as a literary girl not to read from one's own and just feel like, oh, that's what's been wrong the whole time. I get it. I understand why I've had this confusion about all of these books that I love, and yet they don't really have the words for my story. And then she just sort of lays that all out so beautifully.
Now, I love it when Mrs. Van Doren tells Ava to read Edith Wharton, that she'll take Edith Wharton over Henry James every time.
I have to admit that comes from me. I love Edith Wharton, and which is why the literary salon in the book is named after the House of Mirth.
That's perfect.
I love that book. And then also it tells that tale, which I think sort of reflects back on Stephanie, of a young woman really determined to make her way in the world, and the way she kind of ends up using her beauty and her charm and as sort of currency to try and get things from this society that doesn't really value her. And I think that that's a really important theme for the book.
Absolutely. Now, The Little Clan is also a book about literary culture, the high and the low and the social and the solitary parts of it. You really have thought about this a lot and seen a lot.
I have, yes. It was interesting. It sort of came as a surprise to me. Some of this is based on my own experience. I started a literary salon in Manhattan around the turn of the millennium that became a sudden, unexpected success. And I had always been bookish and always wanted to be a writer. And I had this idea from reading all these books that that's what a young writer does. You go out into the world and you visit a salon and you talk to other writers and artists, and there's this whole sense of exchange and community. And so I very much wanted to do that. And then in the process, I started to realize, oh, this is a different thing than writing books. You know, writing books actually happens alone at a desk, and where the personal and the private and sort of the social aspects intersect can be a place to really sort of question a lot of assumptions and learn a lot of things about both yourself and the world and the writers you admire.
Well, what was it like for you? Because I feel that so much of your life as a reader is in this book, and that's been a very rich life. What surprised you thinking about books over the years and what they've meant to you?
What really surprised me at a certain point was when I was writing this book, I basically stopped reading books written by men for the first time in my life.
Wow.
It became ravenous for women's experience. And really became connected to contemporary writing. My background was really just dead white men, which was great. Like, when I was younger, I would just flip to the back of Penguin Classics and say, okay, these are all the important books. Let's get started, and just sort of read them all down the list, which I think is wonderful to know your history and as a writer to be really well-versed in the literary tradition that you're coming out of, and you learn so much about the world and your culture. But then I think as a young woman living in the world today, it's also important to sort of take a step away from all of that and to see what people are writing about now and to listen to the stories that aren't included in that canon, which even though I love it so much, you know, women's stories, people of color stories, like there's just so much that is not spoken for. And so this book was my love letter and my reckoning with this literary history that I have such deep affection for, but that I also had to move away from.
So what are some of the writers, the women writers and writers of color that you've discovered that have meant the most to you?
I was just sort of like going through and reading everybody that was coming out, like Britt Bennett, who are the mothers I love, Caitlin Greenidge, we love you, Charlie Freeman, Jessamine Ward is, of course, amazing.
Oh, yes.
Although her books are so powerful that I can only read them in little bursts, because they're pretty upsetting sometimes. And then essayists, I was reading Leslie Jameson and Claire Dederer. And then I just started going back because I still love old books. And like anything that was published by the New York Review of Books imprint and was written by a woman, I would just get them all. And so I just ended up discovering this whole other subset of sort of classic but less well-known books and just reading sort of all of those that came up, and that was really fun as well. I mean, there's always so much to read, and as soon as you get settled with one strain of interest, then a new one opens up, and you're like, oh, now I've just got hundreds more books to read.
Well, do you ever long for those days when you had the salon? Because it went on for 4 years, which is quite a long time, really.
Yeah, I don't, actually. It turns out that in my heart, I am not that much of an extrovert. It's exhausting throwing parties for a living. I'm a little bit shy in person, and to run something like that, you're constantly sort of producing things and introducing people and throwing events. There's always this dread, what if nobody comes, and feeling responsible for that. And so, while I'm very glad not to be doing it anymore, it was astounding to get to be doing it when I was younger. I mean, we really exploded for a minute, and so I would just look around the room and there were just like all of these famous writers and famous musicians and celebrities and gorgeous people all drinking wine and talking about books. And I would have to sort of shake myself and say, how did this happen? How did this come from something that I made?
And there is this moment of midwifing something when you want people to love books and you think you found a way to make them do that. It's thrilling. It's absolutely thrilling. There's nothing like it.
Yep, you're doing that.
I try. I just love to talk about them. But one of the things that struck me in this book is that there's such tenderness. There's so much tenderness in the way the characters feel for each other and for their books. And I especially love the relationship with the older writer, Constance Berger, that Ava develops near the end of the novel.
Yeah, I'm really grateful for brilliant older women that I can talk to and learn things from. That sort of came to me in my course in graduate school. I got an MFA at Columbia, and getting to talk to these like spectacular women that were my teachers was just so, so valuable. And that feeling really stuck with me, that gratitude. And so I really wanted to put someone in there because a brilliant middle-aged lady writer is right now like my favorite people on the planet.
With great shoes, too. That's the other thing.
She has a bit of an edge.
Oh, man. We've been talking with Iris Cohen, whose wonderful new novel, required reading for all book lovers, is The Little Clan. You can meet her at the Presbyter Sunday, April 22nd from 2 to 4 p.m. Iris, thank you so much.
Oh, Susan, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
See you soon.
Bye.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Jason DeWolf discusses insigns from the Kingdom of Congo to Congo Square. Congo dances and the origins of the Mardi Gras Indians. Sunday, April 15th at 3 at Octavia Books in New Orleans. Virginia Eubanks discusses insigns automating inequality, how high-tech tools profile police and punish the poor. Monday, April 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Brian Camp reads from insigns The City of Lost Fortunes, Tuesday, April 17th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop in New Orleans. Jake Shears, whose new memoir is Boys Keep Swinging, appears in conversation with Gwen Tompkins, Wednesday, April 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Historian Winston Ho discusses Chinese American history in New Orleans, the Presbyterian Mission, Wednesday, April 18th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Friends of the UNO Library hold their annual book sale Thursday, April 19th from 10 to 6. Thursday only, there's an admission charge for the first 2 hours for a first look, but that's free to students and members. The sale continues Friday, April 20th from 10 to 4 and Saturday, April 21st from 10 to 2. It takes place at the UNO Library, fourth floor. Joshua Wheeler discusses and signs his essay collection, Acid West, Thursday, April 19th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Seamus McGraw discusses and signs A Thirsty Land, The Making of an American Water Crisis, Thursday, April 19th at 6 at Octavia Books. The New Orleans Museum of Art hosts Edible Book Day, Saturday, April 21st from 10 to 3 at NOMA. Check out the events calendar at noma.org for details. New Orleans Public Library Director Charles Brown and I will be on hand to judge the gorgeous cakes. Sheba Turk signs Off Air, My Journey to the Anchor Desk, Saturday, April 21st from 2 to 4 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Blue Balliette signs Out of the Wild Night, Saturday, April 21st at 3 at Octavia Books. The New Orleans Poetry Festival is this weekend, April 20th through 22nd at the New Orleans Healing Center and other locations. Special guests include the Baton Rouge Slam Team, Louisiana Poet Laureate Jack Bedell, Douglas Kearney, Dylan Krieger, Tanya Foster, Carolyn Hembry, and many others. Check out nolapoetry.com for the complete schedule. And here at The Reading Life, we're celebrating the New Orleans Tricentennial by putting together a list of 300 great books about New Orleans. Send your favorites to labooks@wwno.org and see if they make the list. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.